The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Well, welcome back. Friday, April 5th, 2024. I am Seth Leibson. Mr. Bill, good to see you, sir. Young David, good to see you. My producer and Miss Terry is here for the rest of you. It's 602-508-0960. Fun Friday today. It's actually a Humanities Day here at the Seth Leibson Show. What do you guys call it around here? SLS?
The SLS, the Seth Leibson Show.
It's a Humanities Day because we're going to be doing some philosophy, some history, and some religion. That's basically what a good humanities department once was. I don't know if there are any left anymore except perhaps at Hillsdale and maybe a few other colleges, but not many. First and foremost, young David, it's important when we talk about culture, we remind ourselves that food is a part of culture. And
that's true.
We're obsessed with that aspect of culture. You had quite the lunch. You had a little
quite
surf and turf. You had a hot dog and a cheeseburger.
Oh, my goodness. Both of those things are from turf.
I call it surf
it's
and
turf. It's a turf and turf.
It's a Leibson surf and turf.
Yes. But I went to this to – you intrigued me.
Yeah.
Your discussions – of Craig's gustatory dalliances yesterday intrigued me.
Yeah.
And so I went to the place that Craig went for lunch yesterday, and I had a Chicago-style slider and a Chicago-style hot dog.
That's not all. I told you
that's
about...
That's not all. Yeah. That's right. I had the double-dip deep-fried fries.
Fries not just fried once, but twice.
I had to test my arteries before I go dancing tonight. You
that's
know,
right.
I figured I could cheat it off tonight through a little bit of a... isometric exercise.
What kind of dancing is that again?
Swing dancing, you know, it's with a partner.
And you'll be wearing...
Some people call it Lindy Hop and things like that. It's a Eastern Harlem style of dancing.
And you'll,
like
you'll be wearing a dinner jacket?
No, I'll be wearing a dinner suit
okay.
because we are strictly a two-piece show on the Seth Leibson Show.
Okay, all right. What's the difference between a dinner suit and a dinner jacket?
A dinner suit has matching trousers. A dinner jacket would be like an off-white jacket, or maybe you're one of those guys that wears a colorful jacket like were popular in the 70s.
Okay.
Dinner suit is a tuxedo, black on black.
And will you wear a ruffled shirt?
What is it?
Pleated.
Pleated, yeah, that's the word I'm looking for here. Pleated shirt.
Do you tie your own bow tie?
Not in this case, no. I had to find one that matched the same material.
Do you know
as
how to
lapel.
Tie a bow tie?
Yes, yes.
I bet
yes,
you do.
This is a more formal bow tie.
I bet you do. You probably also know how to shave with a straight edge.
Yeah, what do you think I did this morning?
Do you use a straight edge?
Double-edged.
Yeah, okay.
I use a double-edged razor.
Welcome back. Okay, enough of that. The reason I was intrigued about tonight's dance is because it's going to interfere with what I'm hoping will be good. One of the few times you'll hear me praise PBS, but they are doing an American Masters series tonight called The Incomparable Mr. Buckley, and it's a special on William F. Buckley, who gets a lot, but maybe not quite enough attention on this show. The Fons et Origio, he might himself say, of the modern conservative movement. And looking forward to watching it tonight. And on Monday, we're going to have a historian friend of mine on the show to review it with us who will be in the documentary, Al Felsenberg, who hasn't been on the show in a while, but an old dear friend of mine who's helped me with a few of my American history projects. He's on the show. He wrote a biography of William Buckley, and we'll talk to him about it. He said he doesn't know. I mean, outside of what they interviewed him on and who knows what they'll use from the interviews with him. He doesn't know what the whole documentary will be like. So we'll talk to him on Monday about it. But I was thinking about Buckley for a couple of reasons. He gave a lot of conservatives their careers. So, for example, many of you know that I was privileged to have a great conservative teacher in college and grad school, Harry Jaffa. Harry said that Buckley gave him his career. I mean, Harry propelled a lot of academics into – William Buckley propelled a lot of academics of that ilk into politics and into popular commentary, not just, you know, the Aryan, you know, academic intellectual recesses and cabins, which a lot of academics exist in, but he brought them out to write for National Review and to become speechwriters. And Harry, of course, wrote the famous Goldwater speech from 1964 and wrote a lot of other popular pieces, too, in the Wall Street Journal and the New York Times, and taught a lot of students. And so anyway, Buckley was really the first conservative who propelled intellectual conservatives into the mainstream of American life, not just academia, brought them, if you will, off of the Mount Olympus and brought them down to earth for the rest of us to learn from. And so for that alone, he should deserve credit. For so many things, he deserved a lot of credit. So I'm glad to see that they'll be doing this special on him tonight. One of the things that is most amusing, and I'm sure will occupy a big part of the documentary tonight on him, will be his run for mayor in New York in 1965. I'd like to read you from a speech of his in 1965 when he announced for mayor. He said, "My own estimate is that some of New York's problems cannot be solved by politics, and that those that can would first require a tweaking of a few taboos by the nose. But since political taboos exist precisely for the benefit of one or another class of voters, it is unlikely that the taboos will be violated and therefore unlikely that the problems will be solved. And I expect that it is the general intuition of that dilemma that lies at the heart of the demoralization that New York's critics have so eloquently berated in article after article and book after book. It is not the economic disorders of New York," writes Mr. Whalen in a galvanizing book, "A City Destroying Itself, that throws a shadow across an urban civilization. The truly terrible costs of New York are special and spiritual. These accrue in endless human discomfort, inconvenience, harassment, and fear, which have become part of the pervasive background like the noise and filth, but are much deadlier. For it is people who breathe life into an environment, who create and sustain a healthy city. People are driven and their senses dulled if they are alienated and dehumanized. The city is on the way to destroying itself. It seems to me highly unlikely that very much can be expected by the way of the people's reanimation if the people's leaders keep missing the point. What is wrong with New York? The taxes are high and the means of collecting them barbarous. The cost per person of operating the government of New York is $412. The comparative cost per person of operating Philadelphia, half that. Chicago, half that. Yet no matter how high the taxes soar, things somehow do not appear to improve. The public schools are not as good as they should be, or at least the children aren't as well educated as they should be. The recreation areas are drab and worse, unsafe. Police protection is inadequate. Garbage collection is irregular and discriminatory. The surrounding rivers are dirty, the air unclean. The traffic congestion is appalling, and the facilities of the rapid transit system are inadequate. Low-cost housing is scarce, and especially scarce for blacks and Puerto Ricans. Much of the new architecture is dispirited and graceless. Great jeremiads can be written, and indeed have been, on each of these major deprivations, which taken together underwrite such a categorical disillusion as Mr. Whalen's. A modern Justine could in New York City wake up in the morning in a room she shares with her unemployed husband and two children, crowd into a subway in which she is hardly able to breathe, disembark at Grand Central and take a crosstown bus, which takes 20 minutes to go the 10 blocks to her textile loft, work a full day, and receive her paycheck, from which a sizable deduction is withdrawn in taxes and union fees, return via the same ordeal, prepare supper for her family, and tune up the radio to full blast to shield the children from the gamey denunciations from her next-door neighbor that is being hurled at her and her husband. She could walk a few blocks past hideous buildings to the neighborhood park to breathe a little fresh air and fall into a coughing fit as the sulfur dioxide excites her latent asthma, go home and, on the way, lose her handbag to a purse snatcher, sit down to oversee her son's homework, only to trip over the fact that he doesn't really know the alphabet, even though he had his 14th birthday yesterday, which he spent in the company of a well-known pusher. She hauls off and smacks him, but he dodges, and she bangs her head against the table. The ambulance is slow in coming, and at the hospital there is no doctor in attendance. An intern finally materializes and sticks her with a shot of morphine, and she dozes off to sleep and dreams of John Lindsay." Can you imagine giving that speech running for mayor in New York 1960? Well, the cops loved him, and the blue-collar workers loved Bill Buckley, and that was kind of the charm, this man of great culture and wealth who could, as I guess Rudyard Kipling would put it, would not lose the common touch. And I remember when he passed, we dedicated a show, Bill Bennett and I, to him, and I'll never forget this truck driver called in and said, I remember when I first heard him, and I hardly understood a thing he was saying, but what I knew is that I wanted to. All right, I'm Seth Leibson, and we'll be right back. I met up with the gambler. We were both too tired to speak, so we took turns of staring at the window at the darkness. Boredom overtook us.
Who's singing? You or Kenny?
I'm talking. He's singing.
You're talking. He's singing.
Welcome back to the Seth Leibson Show, 602-508-0960. Listener Steve writes in, I've subscribed to National Review since 1967. I subscribed to all the booklets which contain transcripts of firing line. I remember those. I did too. They had those firing line specials, and you could order the booklets that had the transcript of them.
Yes.
I remember.
Yes.
It'd take like a month for you to get them.
For $1.67
something
in change,
like
you can have a bound and printed copy
something
of this
like
transcript
that.
Sent to your
something
house.
Like that.
Yes.
It hurts my heart, he writes, to see what National Review has become. Buckley formed my understanding of what it means to be conservative. He led me to all of the great conservative thinkers and authors. He was accessible and witty. He sure was. And yeah, that's right. It hurts my heart, too, to see what National Review has become. The writing is far less. The conservative sensibilities far worse. There's still some great people over there. But there used to be, that would not have been a sentence once upon a time. Everyone was great there once. And it's just not like that anymore. And they have this fundamental, I think, fair to say, my reading of Buckley anyway, history, I mean, it's always dangerous to try and quote someone who's not here to validate his own, what you attribute to him or what you impose on him as a thought. But William Buckley always had the sense, I thought, that you do vote for the most conservative candidate that can win. And National Review has just way too many authors. I was quoting one earlier in the week, was I not, that was on the Hugh Hewitt show saying they just won't vote for Donald Trump. And to not do that, if you call yourself a conservative, is, I think, to betray conservatism because it stands athwart leftism. And whatever imperfection the vehicle, in this case, whatever imperfection you want to find in the standard bearer of the Republican Party. I mean, William Buckley himself had a lot of problems with, you were showing me some Nixon stuff earlier, young David. He had a lot of problems with Nixon, but, you know, at the end of the day, even after trying to run a primary against him and losing, you go for Nixon. And he did run a primary against him, not for himself, but John Ashbrook, right?
Yes,
yeah.
Sure thing.
Yeah.
And remember earlier in the week, you played for me a clip of Buckley on the Dick Cavett Show.
That's right.
That I'd never seen before.
Yeah, that's right.
And if you listen to that in its entirety, it's after the election. And they ask it,
it's right before the election, but after the
primary election, after the convention.
Right.
And they say to him, so does that mean you're perhaps against Mr. Nixon or you're supporting
and
a different candidate?
And
he said, verbatim, I forget. But
I can do it verbatim.
Oh, you've got it verbatim?
He said, oh my God, George McGovern would be 100 times worse. That's exactly what he said. Oh my God, and it's not a phrase I would use much, but I'm quoting directly. Oh my God, George McGovern would be 100 times worse. What happened to that sensibility? Joe Biden would be 100 times worse. That would be the modern application. Am I interrupting you? Go right ahead.
No, I
the other thing he says in there is he had a lot of disagreements with Henry Kissinger, too. And yet he says, but I'm very fond of him.
Mm-hmm.
And
they would called him his friend.
Yeah, they were friends, and they would speak at each other's, you know, birthdays and stuff like that. I ran into Buckley thrice in my life. The first was when I was in the sixth grade.
No way.
Have I never told you this
story? This would have been Buckley in his prime then.
Yeah.
I don't think I've heard this.
Oh, it was great. I was a nerd, like a few others. And I had a friend of mine in sixth grade who was equally nerdy. And we sometimes would wear, you know, ties to school and stuff where there was no dress code. And he introduced me to this William Buckley guy. I had not for some reason heard or known much of him at that time. I don't know why I did or didn't, but I don't know. I was, what, 11, 10? And we got a book of his called Saving the Queen, which was a mystery novel.
Yeah, it's one of his spy books, right?
Blackford Oaks, which I didn't read much of that stuff. I read mostly his nonfiction. And we were on a band trip. We were on a band trip. We had a great music director, Les Felton, who took us on trips to go play. And we were on a trip coming from Disneyland, Anaheim. And over the loudspeaker, we heard, "Mr. William Buckley, your car is waiting for you at whatever it was." And we both looked at each other. What are the chances? You would never have that today, but back in whatever it was, 1980 or whatever, we both looked at each other. "Mr. William Buckley, what are the chances?" And we had the book with us. We had Saving the Queen with us. That's how nerdy everything is here. And we went running and scurrying around the airport, which wasn't too big in those days, I guess, or as big as it would be today. And we saw him. And he's carrying this suitcase-sized compact computer, one of the first mobile, I guess, is that the right word? One of the first portable computers, compact, C-O-M-P-A-Q. And it was huge. Must have weighed, I don't know what it weighed, 15 pounds maybe. I don't know, 12. It was a lift. And we went up to him and we said, "Mr. Buckley, could we have your autograph?" Well, he sees these two 10-year-olds. He was charming anyway. He must have been just blown away. And he sets down his compact. He said, "Why, certainly." And we gave him the book to sign. And he goes, "You always travel around with my books." That was the first time I met him. I reminded him of that story.
Do you still have the book?
It was John's. I hope John still has it, my friend John. I reminded him of that story when I ran into him as an adult, I don't know, in the 90s, I guess, and we were at a convention together where he was one of the speakers, and he said he remembered it. He said, "How many 10-year-olds do you think come up to me at airports with copies of my book to autograph?" He remembered it, but we had a deeper connection because my professor at Claremont, Harry Jaffa, and Charles Kessler. Charles Kessler was a dear friend of William Buckley's as well and was on the board of National Review. So we had a lot to talk about. And then the third time was at his house. I guess they would call it a maisonette. It's a hell of a house. In New York, there was a reception I was at. And one of the things, this was in the aughts, like 2004-ish, somewhere in there. And you don't see this anymore. But the cocktail party, they had silver cigarette dispensers for the guests.
Nice.
You know, you would never see that, and you probably didn't even see it then. But he was. I don't know.
Buckley
wasn't
a smoker, was he?
Huh?
Buckley wasn't a smoker, was he?
Yeah,
he was.
I think so.
I didn't know that.
Yeah,
did not know that.
I think he was. If he wasn't, his wife was. Maybe that's what it was. His wife was. He may not have been. His wife was. Yeah. Anyway, memory lane. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Seth Leibson Show. This is a treat because I get to highlight not only a friend, but a friend to the station and a friend to the community. You hear me often talk about Y-Refi, and they are a great sponsor of this and so many other great shows. But not only that, they're just hugely charitable in the community, and their whole business model is actually based on helping people. So with all the stuff going on in the economy, especially with the Biden plans and college loan bailouts and stuff, I wanted to talk to Lane Schoenberger. He is the chief investment officer and managing partner at Y-Refi. Again, their website is investyrefi.com. Lane has been on the show with us before. It's been too long. Lane, how are you, sir? Thanks for calling in.
Well, it's my pleasure. I'm just about perfect. Thank you, Seth. How are you doing?
I'm hanging in there, sir. I'm hanging in there. Every minute we get closer to 5 or 6 o'clock, I guess, in my case, is a better minute. But, no, I love this. I love what I do. As you love what you do, tell people, you know, we often talk about why refi, and I want to get into the economy and the Biden administration stuff in a minute, but we often say that this is an investment you offer that actually helps people. Say a word about, or as many words as you want, about what YRefi does and how it helps people.
Sure, sure. Thank you. So YRefi, we're focusing on a niche market. And what I mean by that is in the student loan space, there are two types of student loans, essentially. There's federal and there's private. We don't do anything with the federal for a lot of reasons, one of which is the federal government just doesn't get it. But on the private side of student lending, private lenders, banks, various lenders like Sallie Mae and Navient, they actually have a private lending arm as well. And in the private world, you have a co-borrower and it's a credit underwritten, among other things. Well, once you graduate school, if you find yourself in a situation where you're in distress, meaning you're delinquent and then ultimately default on your loan, unlike the federal government where they've got 1,000 programs for you to use to call yourself not in delinquency, no. Private does not.
Right.
They don't have that.
Right.
Right. So the option, there's one path for these borrowers, and the path is very simple. They destroy your credit.
Yeah.
They make your life miserable through collections.
Yeah.
Then they head towards judgment and garnishment of wages.
And you can't discharge these in bankruptcy, right? These are not bankrupt.
That's correct.
Yeah, go on.
That's correct. Right. So yeah, the bankruptcy remote.
Right.
So, you know, these borrowers don't have any options. So what we did was we created a product that actually helps them pay off their debt with dignity.
Mm-hmm.
And it's working beautifully. And our borrowers are winning. Kind of fun to watch them win, frankly. And in the process of doing that, our investors win.
Yeah.
So we raise capital. That's my job, is to raise the capital that we need in order to do what we do.
I know someone who's invested with you, and they said the returns are incredible. It's a hell of a great investment, just for what it's worth. I don't have permission to use his name on air. You may know who I'm speaking of, but in any event, Lane. By the way, do you have to have such a good voice? You're embarrassing me. Yeah, you're going to throw me out of work here. And then what do? I guess I go to YRefi.
There you go. Yeah. They say I have a radio voice and a radio face.
Well, I definitely have the face. I don't have the voice. You have the voice. I'm not going to comment on your face. But Lane Schoenberger is the Chief Investment Officer and Managing Partner at YRefi. InvestYRefi.com. Is the website. By the way, I mentioned that you can't discharge these things in bankruptcy. Every once in a while, irrespective of your business model, Lane, is that a good idea, a reform, or is it a bad idea and reform to make them dischargeable in bankruptcy, would you say?
So, you know, I think there's some value in a review of how it's handled. See, right now there's a thing called a Bruner test, and it's a three-prong test. And what a lot of people don't realize, because you see these articles about bankruptcy being allowed. No, it's not allowed. You have to pass the Bruner test, and you have to pass all three prongs of the Bruner test. Mm-hmm. It's not one or two. It's all three.
Mm-hmm.
And it's virtually impossible. That's why there's only a few cases that have been discharged in bankruptcy.
Yeah.
And at the end of the day, you know, one of the many reasons student loans are bankruptcy remote is because there's no physical asset behind it.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
There's not a piece of property that they can come and get. It's
That's all right. Up
what's going on in the gray matter.
Yeah.
Right? It's education. So
yeah.
if you make them bankruptcy remote, or I'm sorry, you take away the bankruptcy protections, and you're going to have people borrowing money to go to school and then just walking away from the debt.
Can you hold that thought? Can you stay a second segment? This is important, and this was a short segment.
Sure.
We'll have a longer one coming up. Are you good for another slightly longer segment? We'll get into more. Okay, thanks, Lane.
Absolutely.
I appreciate it very much. Lane Schoenberger is my guest. He's the Chief Investment Officer and Managing Partner at YRefi. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Seth Leibson Show. Lane Schoenberger is our guest. He's the Chief Investment Officer and Managing Partner at YRefi, which you hear me speak of often. InvestYRefi.com. That's invest the letter Y, then REFY.com, as you all know. Lane, we were talking about student loan debt, and I had asked you about you know, the reform concept that comes up once in a while about discharging it and make it more easily dischargeable in bankruptcy. You were making the interesting point that one of the problems, one of the many issues in that, is that there's no real asset that's attached, right? That's one of the problems.
That's one of the problems. And you know, here's the other thing, and this is why I believe it's just a political football. You know, student loan debt right now is at $1.8 trillion, okay, mm-hmm. and growing. Mm-hmm. And the lion's share of that is federal. Mm-hmm. That exceeds Canada's entire economy. That exceeds credit card debt in this country. That exceeds auto loan debt in this country. It is the government's largest asset. Okay, so the idea of them giving bankruptcy any kind of real reform or doing away with the bankruptcy protections is excessively unlikely. I mean, just I don't see it happening mm-hmm. because, frankly, from where I sit, I feel like this government likes indentured servitude. Mm-hmm. And why would they give away their largest asset? Mm-hmm. So that's just my opinion, but yep. I think it's, you know, there's some foundation behind it.
No, I think so.
So and then we get asked all the time, Seth, by potential investors, well, what happens if they change the bankruptcy laws? And the real question becomes, how are you protecting the investors? That's really the question behind the question. And, you know, we've analyzed this thing so much. And what I can tell you is that, first of all, if they did do any kind of reform or removal of bankruptcy laws, what we've done to protect our investors is we have a pretty high co-borrower rate, mm-hmm. okay, sitting about 70%. Our average borrower indebtedness not too long ago was sitting about $40,000. It's probably come up a bit simply because of the variable interest rate environment. You know, a lot of people are getting in trouble with their student loans because they're variable interest rates.
Sure.
We do a thorough underwriting process where we have the borrowers escrow with us while we're underwriting to prove that they can afford our payments, mm-hmm. which are typically, by the way, 50% of what they're being asked to pay
yeah.
in their current environment.
Yeah.
So let's pretend they did take away the bankruptcy laws. What now? And I say this all the time. Well, let's play this out. Kid goes into the courtroom, says, I'm going to be smart for a second, Seth. Mm-hmm. Kid goes into the courtroom and he says, Judge, I don't want to pay this anymore. The judge is going to say, well, my courtroom isn't a courtroom if I don't want to. So if you can prove to me you can no longer afford this payment, let's continue. Otherwise, case dismissed. Now, I'm being a little smart, but at the end of the day, let's pretend the judge agrees,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
All right, kiddo, you're out of here.
Mm-hmm.
Mom, dad, grandma, grandpa, you're next. That's how bankruptcy court works.
Right.
So what we're doing is we're protecting our investors with an asset that has multiple borrowers, co-borrowers, et cetera. And we've got thorough underwriting with escrowed accounts and so on. So I'm not sure that I'm worried about bankruptcy.
Yeah, yeah. You know? Well, I don't know if you heard this story.
Too.
I don't know if you heard this or not. I was pleased, and I'm pleased to report it to you. I took a call two Saturdays ago from an old college buddy. I hadn't talked to him in years, and he lives in Connecticut. And he said, I heard your name. Gosh knows how it went, must have gotten through with some stream or podcast he was listening to. He said, I heard your name doing an advertisement for Y Refi. He said, can you really get a 10.25 fixed rate of return? I said, I don't just say things, Lane. Of course.
It's for real.
Yeah, it's for real.
It's for real.
Yes. It's a hell of an opportunity, isn't it?
It is. And, you know, it's fun to help people. You know, so we say doing well by doing good. And
yeah.
the answer is yes, you get to do well. But we also have options for investors. If you go to the investyrefi.com website, you can see we have a one-year investment. It does not pay 10.25. Okay.
A one-year
investment.
Not
a
one.
It's going to pay 6.5.
All right.
But you can get in and dip your toe in the water
yeah.
if you feel like, hey, I want to start out something a little bit smaller and maybe get to know y'all. Great, do a one-year investment, and we'll pay you 6.5% all the way up to 5 years, where we give you 10.25, and it's a fixed interest rate in a secured, collateralized portfolio.
Yep.
And here's some cool stuff. What we do, and we created all of this, there's the software that drives it, everything. So as investors, we calculate interest on a daily basis and make monthly payments of interest only. And at the end of the term or terms, because you can invest in any or all of them if you chose, you get your money back. Very similar to a bond. It's not a bond. It's a promissory note. It's just we structured it to mechanically function that way. Well, then we got really creative. I said, let's give the investor the ability to turn that interest income on or off, up or down, in each term they have invested, as often as monthly. So you've got all this cool control over your investment.
Yep.
If you don't want the income, well, let it compound.
Yep.
Right? You let it compound for a year, you take 10.25 and turn it into 10.75 APY.
The magic of compound interest, Steve Forbes used to say. Yep, exactly right. Exactly right. Well, talk to me and the audience for a second, Tulane, if you don't mind, because I know you guys are strongly opinionated on this. It's an opinion I happen to share. On the Biden administration's cancellation of student debt process, not the process, but the road it's taking us down and what it's going to ultimately cost.
Yes, the political hot potato of the moment.
Yeah.
You know, and I'll say this about both sides: student loan forgiveness is brought up, and you know we're in a election year, so it's going to be even louder.
Yep.
You know, one would have thought he would have learned his lesson when the Supreme Court said no. But here we are, and there's yet one opinion or another on how he's going to try and do some forgiveness and this and that. A lot of the stuff that's been done, and I am vocal about it. You hear in the news, Biden forgives, Biden forgives.
Yep.
Just let's be clear. Most of what he's done is his actual job, which last I recall, he stood there and put his hand on the Bible and swore to do. These have been laws that are in effect for 20 plus years, and all he's done is he's taken the hair out of the drain, and it's working, right?
Yeah.
The PSLF program, that's been around forever. Getting people through that and actually forgiving the loans, congratulations, all you did was fix something that was not fully working, which is your job. The forgiveness of loans some time ago, well, you know, when people die and they become disabled and they were defrauded by their schools, those laws have been around for longer than, longer than he's been in office, but that's a long time.
Yeah.
So, you know, these things are not magical. You know, so to your question, Seth, how do we handle that? Okay, first thing is we only deal in private loans.
That's right.
So federal government cannot forgive private loans.
Right.
It's not their money to forgive.
Yeah.
One could argue that neither is the federal money, but... and not that we endorse or like or agree with the idea of forgiveness. Believe it or not, it will actually help us and our investors if there was any kind of forgiveness.
Mm-hmm.
And the question becomes why?
Mm-hmm.
Well, because most borrowers that have private loans also have federal loans.
Yeah.
So forgiveness of federal frees up cash flow.
Yeah.
Freed up cash flow allows borrowers to make more payments on their private and other debt.
Makes sense.
That's the simple fact.
That makes sense. Well, Lane, you guys are great. I love you and your partner. I love your whole team. I know most of them. And
thank you.
And, you know, you're just a great company in our community because, you know, you always say yes whenever there's a need. And you're always there for us, as you are for your customers and as you are for those you're trying to help. So thanks for stopping by, at least on the phone. And look forward to seeing you again in person one of these days if your partner doesn't
pleasure
make
was mine.
Play
Thank
trumpet.
You for having me.
All right, Lane. Send my
Carter
regards.
He walked by and he waved as he walked by, so he's listening on his headset. And
God love you.
You know, he's the guy that you get to play trumpet with.
Yeah, love you guys. All right, have a good weekend.
Well, welcome back to the Seth Leibson Show, young David. Oh, yeah, you put out a new food video this week, didn't you, on Answer the Call with Dahl. You do these great food cooking videos on Instagram.
Yeah, that's right. It was the Waldorf salad.
Yeah.
I mean, we discussed this, like, on Monday, right?
I don't know that we did.
Oh, well, it was of the Waldorf salad that I had made for my Easter brunch.
Yeah.
Yep.
Good. And you also ran out of gas. I wrote that down. How does anyone run out of gas?
Oh, my goodness. This is
pathetic.
Because, like I told you yesterday, I was knocking on everybody's door in LD5's precinct that I am running for precinct committeeman in.
Right.
And I was just so engrossed in the ascertaining of signatures that I failed to realize that the gas gauge in the vehicle I was using did not function.
Yeah. This is like the student that returned a week late to prep school, and when he was called in by the principal, by the headmaster, as Buckley told the story, he said, I was in Europe over the summer and got so lost in ancient studies that I was operating on the pre-Gregorian calendar. And I apologize. And the headmaster said, well, if you were, you'd have been here a week early. It's like that. Answer the Call with Dahl is his Instagram account where you can get these great cooking videos that he does. And if you do live in LD5 and are hopefully a voter in the Republican Party, you can vote for David Dahl as your precinct committeeman. If you live in the right precinct, you'll see for you'll see his and Barry Goldwater Jr.'s
names. Yes, you'll see mine and Barry Goldwater Jr.'s names.
And you can vote for both of them.
Yes, please vote for both of us, assuming that both of our signatures and everything is processed correctly.
Oh, I'm sure they'll be fine.
And, yeah.
I want you all to take a look at this story before I go to the break here. There's a brand new, huge study. Believe data, not activists, Carol Markowitz writes at the New York Post. Transgenderism among kids is mostly a fad. Researchers at the Netherlands University of Groningen recently released the results of a landmark 15-year study of 2,700 children starting at age 11. In early adolescence, 11% of the participants reported gender non-contentedness. The prevalence decreased with age and was 4% at the last follow-up around age 26. This whole notion that kids feel they must need to change their sex, their gender, it disappears with age when they don't. Keep that in mind. All right. What do we got next? Oh, Marshall Trimble. How fun. Marshall Trimble up next.
3-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.